Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Samuel chapter 31, the last chapter in 1 Samuel. I will entitle this chapter, Saul Takes His Life. Our context is this. Several chapters back, 1 Samuel chapter 28, the Philistines have marched on Israel. They've marched north to a place called Shunem, which is in the Jezreel Valley, and the armies of Saul had gone up to meet him. They were in Jezreel on the southern part of the same Jezreel Valley. And we left them camped there as David is dismissed from the Philistine army. He's in the army of Achish, the king of Gath, because he had pretended that he was Achish's ally, but he wasn't. And the commanders of the Philistines thought, oh my gosh, we can't trust David. And so Achish, you need to get rid of him. And so Achish sent David back to Ziklag, which was a city that was owned by Achish in the southwest of Israel in Philistia. So David had gone back there. We see his town of Ziklag had been attacked by the Amalekites. David goes and gets his booty back, and all that was done in the last chapter, chapter 30. And so now we're going back from what happened with David at Ziklag. We're going back up into the north here, the Valley of Jezreel, and we'll look at Saul's last battle. We start down 1 Samuel 31, verses 1 through 3. Now the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines killed Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. The battle went heavily against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. Now it says in verse 1, the men of Israel fled. Jameson Fawcett Brown says about this, quote, Israelites were forced to give way, being annoyed by the armies, by the arrows of the enemy, which, destroying them at a distance before they came in close combat, threw them into panic and disorder. I guess because it says that Saul was badly wounded by the archers. Jameson Fawcett Brown speculate that the Philistines used archers to win the battle, which could very well be. Now, they fled. Where did they flee from? Well, they fled probably from somewhere around Jezreel where this final battle took place. They fled from Jezreel to Gilboa, so we need to look at the map here. We also need to look at some scriptures in 1 Samuel 28 and 29 that show how the Philistines moved. We start in 1 Samuel 28, 4, the Philistines came together and camped at Shunem. So let's look at Shunem. You look at the Valley of Jezreel, you go down from northwest to southeast as you approach the Jordan River. You're still, 10 or 15 miles away from it. You'll see something there called the Spring of Harod. That's where Gideon had his battle. And maybe about 5 miles northwest of the Spring of Harod is Shunem. Now about 5 or 6 miles south of Shunem is Jezreel, still in the Valley of Jezreel. The valley gets its name from the town Jezreel. So the Philistines are north of Jezreel. Saul gathered all Israel and they camped at Gilboa in 1 Samuel 28, 4. Mount Gilboa is about 10 miles to the south of Shunem, to the southeast of Shunem, on the southern edge of the Valley of Jezreel. It's even closer to the Jordan River. It's about 7 or 8 miles southwest of Jezreel. Now we read in 1 Samuel 29, verse 1, the Philistines brought all their military units together at Aphek. That place has been lost. I assume it's near Jezreel somewhere. So they went from Shunem down to Aphek, wherever that was, while Israel was camped by the spring in Jezreel. So the Philistines are getting closer to the camp of Israel, which is at Jezreel. And then in 1 Samuel 29:11, so David and his men got up early in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines. That's when they left the Philistine army. And the Philistines went up to Jezreel. So the Philistines went from Shunem to Aphek to Jezreel. And Israel was camped in Jezreel. So that's where I assume the battle took place. And then when they got beat, the Israelites did, they retreated southeast to Mount Gilboa. Now, Jameson Fawcett Brown says after they retreated, quote, taking advantage of the heights of Mount Gilboa, the Israelites attempted to rally, but in vain. Saul and his sons fought like heroes, but the onset of the Philistines being at length mainly directed against the quarter where they were, Jonathan and two brothers, Abinadab or Ishvi, and Malchishua, overpowered by numbers, were killed on the spot. So Mount Gilboa is the place where the Benjaminite dynasty of Saul died. Jonathan and his two brothers were probably killed by archers because Saul was heavily wounded by archers. We assume the same thing happened to the sons. Now, Jonathan's death is kind of sad because Jonathan was a good guy, as we know from his relationship with David. But his death helped pave David's way to the throne. Jonathan would not have opposed David if he had lived, but the people would have put Jonathan up, or some people would have put Jonathan up and insisted that he be king because he's the rightful heir. We know how people are about how kingship passes on. You might be a jerk, but if you're the son of the king, you have a claim to the king. At least it's that way in the Middle Ages. I assume it's the same way here in the ancient Near East. Now, Jonathan could say, no people. I'm going to make David king. I don't want to be king. But if he did that, it would not look so much as if God had not acted providentially in order to put David on the throne, which God had done. Because after all, David's nothing but an outlaw at this point. And of course, Jonathan was the oldest son and heir of Saul, and he's gone now. So are the other two sons. The fourth son, Ishbosheth, was not killed. Why? Perhaps he escaped from the battle with Abner, the head of Saul's forces, Saul's first cousin. Perhaps Ishbosheth was left at home in Gibeah, back in Benjamin. Maybe he was considered unfit for battle, or maybe he was needed to take care of the government back home. Or maybe Saul was thinking, if I lose this battle, it'd be nice if I had an heir still alive to take the throne. And so he left Ishbosheth back there to keep him safe and out of the battle. That's my speculation. For whatever reason, Ishbosheth survives, and he's going to show up in the story of the monarchy a little bit later. Now, Jonathan's brother that was killed, there were two of them, one of them that was killed was called Abinadab. His name is also Ishvi. Sometimes people say Ishvi. Ishvi, I-S-H-V-I. 1 Samuel 14:49. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan and Ishvi and Melchishua. So Ishvi is called Ishvi in 1 Samuel 14:49, and here in 1 Samuel 31:2, he's called Abinadab. They're not important. He got killed and got nailed up on a wall, which we'll see in just a minute. We go down to 1 Samuel 31:4. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and pierce me through with it. Otherwise, these uncircumcised will come and pierce me through and make sport of me." But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. So Saul took his sword and fell on it. Now, why did Saul want to have himself killed? Well, this is not surprising. It happened all the time in ancient warfare. Because if you lost a battle, if you were a captured general or a captured king, you were often tortured. You were often mutilated. Sometimes captives were skinned alive, as the NIV Study Bible says. Sometimes captives had iron hooks placed in their flesh so they could be dragged by horses. Sometimes their body parts were cut off. I like in medieval England, a lot of people who would get executed had their testicles cut off and stuffed in their mouth. Horrible way to die, folks. I don't know what they were going to do to Saul, but Saul knew it wasn't going to be pleasant, so he says, "Kill me, armor bearer." The armor bearer wouldn't do it. Why not? Well, perhaps he, like David, did not want to kill the Lord's anointed. This was a king. Regicide's a terrible thing, but this is not really regicide because he was requested to be killed. But the armor bearer might have been afraid that the Israelites would later call him to account for killing the king. "Oh, you killed the king, huh? Did he tell you to do that?" "Yes, he did." "Can you prove it? How do you know he wouldn't have lived?" So the armor bearer was scared to do it. That's understandable. I'd be scared to do it too. So Saul took his sword and fell on it. Who's the "his" refer to? Well, could be the armor bearer's sword. Adam Clark says it's the armor bearer's sword. Actually, the Hebrew is "the sword." So Saul took the sword and fell on it. It doesn't really say whose sword it is. But if it's the armor bearer's sword, this might have significance. If the armor bearer was Doeg the Edomite, which is a Jewish tradition that the armor bearer was Doeg the Edomite. Now, he was the guy that Saul sent up to Nob to kill the 85 priests up there because Ahimelech, the high priest up there, had given David bread when David was on the lam from Saul. And Saul had sent Doeg the Edomite up there to do the dirty work. Well, now, later on in a couple of verses, we're going to see the armor bearer falls on the sword, too. Now, if this sword that Saul fell on was the armor bearer's sword and not Saul's own sword, and if the armor bearer was Doeg the Edomite, this would create a great irony. It would mean that the same sword that killed those 85 priests is the same sword that killed the king who ordered the genocide, the mass murder, and the same sword would kill the executioner who carried out the mass murder. But oh, that's just a nice story. We don't know who the armor bearer was. So Saul falls either on his sword or the armor bearer's sword. So it was a suicide. And we know that suicide is a sin. So are we going to say that Saul sinned here? One way we can defend Saul, and we could say, well, it wasn't actually a suicide because the text doesn't actually say Saul killed himself. It just said he fell on his sword. He tried to kill himself. Josephus says that Saul's attempt to kill himself failed. And the Amalekite, who later came down to David with the crown, with his Saul's crown and bracelet, said, look here, David, I killed Saul. And David wasn't happy about it and bumped off the Amalekite. Josephus says it was that Amalekite who actually did finish him off. And the Amalekite was not just telling a tall tale to get a reward. I don't think so. I think Saul killed himself. Well, that would be one way you could defend Saul from the sin, from being guilty of the sin of suicide. Here's another way. Well, he was mortally wounded anyway, right? So how did he kill himself by falling on the sword? He would have died anyway. Here's what Adam Clark says. Adam Clark is really soft on Saul. Here's what Clark says, quote, to the question, was not Saul a self-murderer? I scruple not to answer. No. That's old-fashioned English, sometimes hard to understand. I scruple not to answer means I don't have any problem with answering. No, he was not a self-murderer. He was to all appearance mortally wounded, Clark continues, when he begged his armor-bearer to extinguish the remaining spark of life. And he was afraid that the Philistines might abuse his body if they found him alive. And we can scarcely say how much of indignity is implied in this word. And his falling on his sword was a fit of desperation, which doubtless was the issue of a mind greatly agitated and full of distraction. A few minutes longer and his life would in all probability have ebbed out. But though this wound accelerated his death, yet it could not be properly the cause of it, as he was mortally wounded before and did it on the conviction that he could not survive. Well, as soon as I read that, that reminded me of a very famous case that I had read in law school years ago, and I still remembered it because it was such an interesting case. In San Francisco, the Chinese people in San Francisco were divided up into gangs, and they were having gang wars. They called them the Tong Wars. And there was one gentleman that had gotten involved in this war, and he was mortally wounded. He was dying. And somebody went up to him and bumped him off. Same situation with Saul. That man was convicted by the court because, I guess on the principle that you take your victim as you find him, and just because he's about to die, if you bump him off, you killed him. So, yeah, I think Saul committed suicide. I mean, I'm very sympathetic with him. How can you help but be sympathetic knowing how brutal things were back then? And I realize it was the custom. I still don't think you have a right to take your own life, though. Not whatever the circumstances are. You know, there's a lot of people in bad circumstances like that that don't take their lives. They just sit and face the music. Lots of people do that, so Saul didn't. I don't think Adam Clark has sufficiently defended his client. We go now to 1 Samuel 31, verses 5 through 6. When his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. Thus Saul died with his three sons, his armor-bearer, and all his men on that day together. Now, why did the armor-bearer commit suicide? Well, here's some options suggested by my NIV study Bible. Option number one, the reason he killed himself is because he would probably be tortured and humiliated by the Philistines if he were captured alive, just like Saul, and that's probably true. Option number two, if he retreated, he would be shamed by the Israelites for deserting the king, as the king, right when the king has died in his moment of extreme trouble. You left him? You just left him to die there? I can see the Israelites getting on him. And besides, he probably couldn't escape anyway. If he tried to escape, the Philistines would have caught him and killed him. Another reason he may have stayed there and killed himself because he was so dedicated to the king. He wanted to die with him. Now, the death of the armor-bearer and Saul was different than the death of Saul's three sons. The three sons died honorably in the field of battle, but Saul and his armor-bearer destroyed themselves. Not quite so honorable. Might be understandable, but it's not honorable. And so ended the reign of a king who was chosen in opposition to the will of God. Remember the people, we got to have a king. And Samuel said, nope, it's not going to be good. This is not God's will. Well, no, we got to have a king, Samuel. Well, that's their king. Here he is. We're not finished with his degradation. Now, James and Brown say that in the providence of God, those three sons, the three oldest and energetic sons, were the ones that died. They were the ones that could have been alive in order to inherit Saul's kingdom and to keep Saul's dynasty going and to keep Saul's dynasty from losing the kingdom to David. But since Saul and the three sons died, that really helped David out in his attempts to accede to the throne. Notice that this verse says that not only Saul and his three sons and the armor bearer, but also all his men died that day. Well, who were all his men? Well, if we look at 1 Chronicles 10:6, it's all of Saul's servants of some sort, maybe his bodyguard. 1 Chronicles 10:6, thus Saul died with his three sons, and all those of his house died together. Those of his house, that would be his servants, and that could very well be a bodyguard of some sort. We go now to 1 Samuel 31:7. When the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley, with those who were beyond the Jordan, saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned the cities and fled, and then the Philistines came and lived in them. On the other side of the valley, which valley? The valley of Jezreel, where this battle took place, at near the town of Jezreel. The other side, since Jezreel is to the south of the valley, the other side will be to the north of the valley. Issachar is the little tribe that's up there at south. Western tip of the Sea of Galilee. Go up the Valley of Jezreel further, you get Zebulun. You go north to the Sea of Galilee and to Lake Hula, going further north up the Jordan River. The Naphtali is the tribe right to the west of Lake Hula and Lake Galilee. All in that area. I guess you could include Asher too, which is to the north and on the Mediterranean coast. The Israelites just took off. Philistines took over the cities without having a fire shot. Without having to do a thing, they just walked in. So this was a tremendous defeat. And notice that it hurt David, because when David took over his kingdom, he had already lost two or three or four tribes worth of territory up there in the north. Ellicott, the commentator, says that the other side of the valley is Issachar, Zebulun, and Naphtali. And I added Asher, because I don't know why Asher would not be included. Also, the Israelites beyond the Jordan, they abandoned their cities. Now, beyond the Jordan, of course, is to the east of the Jordan. That's East Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben, as you're going from north to south. Now, John Gill says that there's a problem here of saying that Israelites in those areas abandoned their cities, because those Israelites, according to Gill, would not be afraid of the Philistines on the far side of the Jordan. Philistines too far away to cause them trouble. Gill says further, nor do we ever read elsewhere of the Philistines crossing the Jordan. Well, John Gill has his answer to that. He says the Hebrew should be rendered that side of the Jordan, which, of course, would be the west side, not the east side, side where the big battle took place. Well, maybe. Adam Clark has no trouble with the Philistines causing fear to the Israelites on the eastern side of the Jordan, because the Philistines possess Beth Shan, which we'll look at in just a minute, which is a city about 5 miles on the west side of the Sea of Galilee, and it's a simple hop, skip, and a jump across the Jordan River to get to the other side. And so it would make sense that the Israelites in Transjordan would be heading out of town. So we go now to 1 Samuel 31:8-10. It came about on the next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head and stripped off his weapons, and sent them throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. They put his weapons in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. All right, well, let's start with the two places first. The Temple of Ashtaroth, most commentators think, is the famous Astarte Temple at Ascalon, one of the five famous Philistine cities on the Mediterranean coast, Gaza being to the south and Ashdod being to the north of Ascalon. Ascalon's in the middle of those three Philistine cities. There was a famous temple to the famous goddess Astarte, from which we get Astarte eggs, Easter eggs. She was mainly prominent in present-day Lebanon, Phoenicia, ancient Phoenicia. And this famous Astarte temple was actually mentioned by the famous Greek historian Herodotus. Herodotus says that this temple at Ascalon for Astarte was the most ancient Astarte temple that existed, according to the Cambridge commentary. And Ellicott, Cambridge, and Barnes all buy this and say that's the Astarte temple at Ascalon that's mentioned in this verse. But there's another option, because the word Astarte in the Hebrew is in the plural, and so Colin Delitch says that the temple of Ashtaroth here is actually the temples of Ashtaroth, which are scattered all throughout Philistia in indefinite places. But I'm going to say it's in Ascalon. Ascalon is a place now that has a oil hub that ships oil right across. That comes in from the Gulf of Aqaba, from India, all across up to the Negev. Well, yes, through the Negev in a pipeline, and it hits Ascalon, and then it goes shipped to European countries on the Mediterranean Sea. So it's still there today. All right, so that's the Temple of Ashtaroth. We're going to mention in First Chronicles the house of Dagon, which is in Ashdod. Ashdod is to the north of Ascalon, right near the Mediterranean coast. It was also one of the five famous Mediterranean cities. Verse 8 says that it was on the next day that the Philistines came to strip the slain. How would that be? Probably the battle lasted all day long. There was no time till the next day in order to plunder the dead Israeli soldiers. So that happened on the next day. They came to the battlefield. They found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They were dead. They cut off his head, cut off Saul's head, and stripped off his weapons. Now, what's going to happen here is we're going to have different parts of Saul carried to different places, and likewise with his son. So let's, to make this simpler, let's divide Saul up into his head, his body, and his weapons, including his armor, which is basically a defensive weapon. His head, his body, and his weapons. Likewise for the sons. And I'm just going to give you a heads up here. This is how it worked. Saul's head goes to the temple of Dagon, the fish god, at Ashdod, which is north of Ascalon, north of the temple of Astarte, on the Mediterranean coast. That's Saul's head. His weapons and armor were taken a little bit further south and put in the temple of Astarte at Ascalon. His body was nailed up on the walls of Bethshan, and I haven't told you where Bethshan is. If you look at Jezreel and go about 8 miles, mostly east, a little bit south, you run into Bethshan, which is about 5 miles, 4 or 5 miles from the Jordan River. I'm going to talk about Bethshan in a minute, but just remember, Saul's body's nailed up there. All right, so his body's at Bethshan. His head's in Ashdod in the temple of Dagon, and his weapons are in the temple of Astarte at Ascalon. Now, as far as the kids, the sons, the only thing that the text says that tells us where they ended up, their bodies were nailed up on the wall of Bethshan along with Saul's body. We don't know what happened to their heads and weapons. I assume the same thing happened to them that happened to Saul. Their heads were probably put into the temple of Dagon and Ashdod, and their weapons were probably put into the temple of Ascalon, Astarte at Ascalon. Don't know. Now, the weapons of Saul were put into the temple of Astarte at Ascalon, but not his crown and his bracelet. Remember, well, you don't, we haven't gotten there yet, but later on in our story, we're going to see an Amalekite is going to go to David back down to the south and say, David, I killed Saul. Here's his bracelet. Here's his crown. And David got very upset. You touched the anointed of God, and he kills the Amalekite. So the crown and the bracelet weren't there, but everything else is in the temple of Astarte at Ascalon. And verse 9, it says, the Philistines cut off Saul's head and stripped off his weapons and sent them throughout the land of the Philistines. Why did the Philistines send the head and the weapons of Saul throughout the lands of the Philistines? For show. If that were the case, the show would have been done before the head and the weapons ended up in their final resting place. Some people say, no, they didn't show off the head and the weapons throughout the land of the Philistines. I bet they did. I don't know. It's speculation. Now, why were Saul's weapons, and possibly the son's weapons, why were they put into that temple of Astarte at Ascalon? Why? Well, this was a kind of a sacrifice to the Astarte. And I assume the head and the fish would, and up north in Ashdod would be a sacrifice to the fish god Dagon. It's a sacrifice, thanking the pagan gods for supposedly helping them win the battle. You remember Goliath's sword was put in the Israelite tabernacle after David beat Goliath, 1 Samuel 21:9. Then the priest said, the sword of Goliath the Philistine, this is Ahimelech up at Nob. David went up there and Ahimelech said to him, the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, behold, it is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you would take it for yourself, take it. David said, there is none like it. Give it to me. David needed some weapons. So that was a typical thing. You put your weapons up into your temple and say, thank you, our God, for helping us use these weapons to win the battle. John Gill states that, quote, nothing was more common with the Gentiles than to place in their temples the arms they took from their enemies, as is strongly expressed by Homer and Virgil. So this is a normal thing. Now Saul's body, as well as the bodies of his three sons, were nailed to a wall in Bethshan. Now we have a question here. How do we reconcile that with what is said in 2 Samuel 21, verse 12? Then David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan, his son, from the men of Jabesh Gilead, who had stolen them from the open square of Bethshan. We'll see in a minute that there was a town across the Jordan River named Jabesh Gilead, and they had gone and gotten the bodies off the walls there in Bethshan. But it says in 2 Samuel 21:12, they didn't get them from the wall of Bethshan. They got the bodies from the open square of Bethshan, where the Philistines had hanged them on the day the Philistines struck down Saul and Gilboa. I don't know why I couldn't find any commentator making a comment about that, and so I'm just going to have to try to reconcile it myself. My idea is there was a wall which fronted on the public square. Maybe even there was a wall in the public square, and it was a public place because it was a public square, and that's why they put the bodies there. That's my speculation anyway. Well, let's look at this Bethshan, this city of Bethshan. It's an interesting place. I've actually been there. The name Bethshan means house of security. Beth is house. Shan is security. House of rest, house of security. The city belonged to the tribe of Manasseh, on the west side of the Jordan, of course, about 4 or 5 miles. The body of Saul and his sons were fastened to its walls. I'm reading from Easton's dictionary. In Solomon's time, it gave its name to a district, the district of Bethshan. It is on the road from Jerusalem to Damascus. You go through Bethshan, across the Jordan River, and then northeast up to Damascus, Syria. It's about 5 miles from the Jordan and 14 from the south end of the Lake of Galilee. After the captivity, it was called Scythopolis, the city of the Scythians, who about B.C. 640 came down from the steppes of southern Russia and settled in different places in Syria. Now, that's interesting. I knew it was called Scythopolis. I didn't know why. I thought the Romans had named it that for some reason. Well, that's why. In fact, when we were on my wife and I were touring Israel, the tour guide took us to a place called Scythopolis. They didn't call it Bethshan. And I didn't realize that the southern Russians from the steppes there, I didn't realize they had made it all the way down from the Caucasus through present-day Armenia and Azerbaijan between the Black Sea and the Caucasus Sea, and then further on down through eastern Turkey and then through Syria and then all the way into Israel. I didn't realize that. The Romans were constantly fighting the Scythians. But at any rate, Scythopolis or Bethshan is an interesting place. The tour guide didn't even mention Saul's bodies getting nailed up on a wall there. And I was looking around, where did they nail those bodies? But he didn't even say a thing about it. Maybe it was embarrassing because it didn't reflect well on Israel's history. I don't know, but he didn't mention it. They did show us a bunch of Roman ruins and a urinal, I remember. They showed us how they ran running water through the public bathroom there and how you would sit on these stone toilets with slits in the stones to do your business. I thought it was the first time I'd ever seen how Romans went to the bathroom in public places. But at any rate, if you ever get a chance to go to Israel, Bethshan's a place to go to. And it's also notable because it's the place where Saul died and the Benjaminite monarchy died. There's something else interesting about Bethshan. The Canaanites were living there. In Judges 1:27-28, we read this. At that time, Manasseh failed to take possession of Bethshan. Remember, Bethshan is in the tribe of Manasseh, western Manasseh. But Manasseh failed to take possession of it and its villages and other places too they didn't take possession of. And then verse 28, when Israel became stronger, they made the Canaanites serve as forced labor, but they never drove them out completely. So living in the city of Bethshan were Canaanites, and I bet they were really happy to see the king of Israel nailed up on the walls of Bethshan, as Ellicott points out. We go now to 1 Samuel 31, verses 11 through 13, and we will finish this audio, this chapter, and this book. Now when the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men rose and walked all night, and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan, and they came to Jabesh and burned them there. They took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. Well, we look at the map. If you look at Bethshan and go those 5 miles straight east along, I don't know what wadi that is. It's not marked on my map, and I don't know. But anyway, 5 miles along the wadi there, you hit the Jordan River, and you go south about 7 or 8 miles. Then you hit another wadi. That wadi is called Yabis, Y-A-B-I-S. And then you take that wadi and go due east through the plain of Gilead, then through the mountains that ring the plain of Gilead, that border the plain of Gilead. Keep going through those mountains. And then north of that Wadi Yabesh, there's Jabesh Gilead. It's about, 8 miles or so east of the Jordan River. Now, Jabesh Gilead shows up a lot. Let me read you from Easton's. It's a town on the east of the Jordan, on top of one of the green hills of Gilead, within the limits of the half-tribe of Manasseh, and in full view of Bethshan. It is first mentioned in connection with the vengeance taken on its inhabitants because they refused to come up to Mizpah to take part with Israel against the tribe of Benjamin. Now, if you recall, this is in Judges chapter 21. There was a Benjamite who was very naughty. He raped a Levite's daughter, and the rest of Israel found out about it when the Levite took pieces of his daughter, put them on donkeys, and sent them out through the tribes of Israel. And so the tribes of Israel went down to Mizpah and said, "Hey, Benjamin," this is Mizpah in Benjamin, I think it's right north of Ramah, and said, "Hey, what you going to do? Give us the murderer. We need to do justice." And the Benjaminites said, "You're not going to touch him." And so the rest of the Israel said, "Okay, we're going to wipe you out." And they did. They fought Benjamin at Gibeah, but then they were scared that they had wiped out a tribe of Israel, which was a no-no. And so they went up against Jabesh-Gilead, and they killed everybody in Jabesh-Gilead and took 400 women from Jabesh-Gilead and brought them back and gave them to the Benjaminites. So Jabesh-Gilead's a famous place. After that happened, the city was taken by Nahash, king of the Ammonites. Of course, the Ammonites are right in the same general area there, in the Transjordan area. The Ammonites take the city, but the city was delivered by Saul, the newly elected king of Israel. This is the first battle that Saul did. We've talked about that already. In gratitude for this deliverance, 40 years after this, the men of Jabesh-Gilead took down the bodies of Saul and of his three sons from the walls of Bethshan, and after burning them, buried the bones under a tree near the city. David, we're going to see in 2 Samuel 2 in a couple chapters, David thanked them for this act of piety and afterwards transferred the remains to the royal sepulcher, which I assume was in Jerusalem. So there is the history of Jabesh. Now note that the men of Jabesh-Gilead, in coming to Bethshan, crossing the Jordan River, going to Bethshan up the Jezreel Valley there, that's a distance as the crow flies of about, I'd say 15 miles, maybe 13, 14, 15 miles. In doing that, they were risking a lot. They marched at night. Why? To keep their actions secret, and maybe so they had to do it now. They didn't have, as soon as they found out about what happened, they took off. Because Saul's body could have easily been destroyed by Philistines, by vultures, by animals. Well, the Philistines hung them up on the walls of Bethshan. I guess they weren't going to destroy the body. They were hanging them up as trophies, but somebody could have taken them down and desecrated the bodies, or animals could have got them. And also, they probably traveled at night, the men of Jabesh-Gilead did, because they didn't want to get caught by the Philistines, honoring the Philistines' enemies, Saul and his sons. In verse 12, the men of Jabesh-Gilead took the bodies off the walls and they burned them. Now, this is against the usual Israelite practice. Israelites did not cremate bodies. They historically have had an aversion to cremating bodies, as the NIV Study Bible says. And when a body was burned, it was usually or probably done in connection with sin. Leviticus 20:14, if there's a man who marries a woman and her mother, it is immorality. Both he and they shall be burned with fire. Ooh, don't marry a woman and her mother. That's bad business. Leviticus 21:9, also the daughter of any priest, if she profanes herself by harlotry, she profanes her father, she shall be burned with fire. If you were a priest's daughter, you had a higher standard than the average girl. And if you committed sexual sin, you were toast, man. You were burned. But that was unusual situations in the law. Some men have said that the men of Jabesh-Gilead saw Saul as a sinner, and that's why they burned him. I don't think so. I think the reason was is they couldn't preserve the bodies. The body was putrefying. The bodies were putrefying, and so they had to burn the bodies. The NIV Study Bible comes up with that idea, and I disagree with it. I don't think the men of Jabesh-Gilead would go to so much trouble to honor a sinner if they thought Saul was a sinner. I think they were giving him thanks for rescuing them from Nahash the Ammonite several years previously. Now, here's some options given by commentators as to why the men of Jabesh-Gilead burnt the bodies. Option number one, to keep the Philistines from discovering and recovering the bodies once they had taken them down off the wall. The Philistines would probably be upset about that. So they burnt the bodies and say, "Okay, Philistines, you're not going to get them now." The NIV Study Bible says that men of Jabesh-Gilead took the bodies down to prevent further decomposition and disfigurement. It was too late to embalm them, as the Hebrews normally did, Adam Clark said, so they had no choice. John Gill in the NIV Study Bible says the bodies had become putrid and infectious, so they had to burn them. That's only the flesh now. They saved the bones. They took the bones back to Jabesh-Gilead and buried them under a tamarisk tree. Second Chronicles says an oak tree. I don't know what the difference is. I imagine they're close. And that's why the two different words are used in the two different accounts. I'm not a botanist. I don't know. And I don't really care. And so ends the life of Israel's first king, Saul. And I'm going to give you a great summary of his life by Adam Clark. And we'll finish up this chapter and we'll finish up the book of 1 Samuel. Quote, "Thus ends the troublesome, and I had almost said the useless, reign of Saul. A king was chosen in opposition to the will of the Most High, and the government of God in effect rejected it to make way for this king." Remember the people, they wanted a king. We've got to have a king, Samuel. The Philistines are upon us. We need a king. Clark continues, "Saul was at first a very humble young man and conducted himself with great propriety, but his elevation made him proud, and he soon became tyrannical in his private conduct and in his political measures. His natural temper was not good. He was peevish, fretful, and often outrageous. And these bad dispositions, unchecked by proper application to the grace of God, became every day more headstrong and dangerous. Through their violence, he seems at times to have been wholly carried away and deranged. And this derangement appears to have been occasionally greatly exacerbated by diabolical influences. This led him to take his friends for his foes, so that in his paroxysms, he strove to imbrue his hands in their blood." There's that old-fashioned English word again, imbrue his hands in their blood. "And more than once attempted to assassinate his own son, and most causelessly and inhumanly ordered the innocent priest of the Lord at Nob to be murdered. More than once attempted to assassinate Jonathan. I knew once he did. I don't know about twice. That's interesting. This was the worst act in his whole life, killing those priests. Saul was but ill qualified for a proper discharge of the regal functions. The reader will remember that he was chosen rather as a general of the armies than as a civil governor. The administration of the affairs of the state was left chiefly to Samuel, and Saul led forth the armies to battle. As a general, he gave proof of considerable capacity. He was courageous, prompt, decisive, and persevering. And except in the last unfortunate battle in which he lost his life, generally led his troops to victory. Saul was a weak man and very capricious. This is amply proved by his unreasonable jealousy against David and his continual suspicion that all were leagued against him. It is also evident in his foolish adjuration relative to the matter of the honey, in which, to save his rash and nonsensical oath, he would have sacrificed Jonathan his son." That was the story after they had won in Michmash, I believe it was, and the Philistines were routed and running, and the Israelite army was chasing them. Saul imposed a ridiculous wrath on his soldiers and said, "You're not going to eat anything. There's honey everywhere, but you're not going to eat it. You're not going to eat it until you get all these Philistines." And they just wore out. So it was a stupid rash. The question, was Saul a good king, has already in effect been answered. He was on the whole a good man, as far as we know, in private life, but he was a bad king, for he endeavored to reign independently of the Jewish constitution. He in effect assumed the sacerdotal office and functions, and thus even changed what was essential to that constitution. I think what Clark is saying there, and my memory is fuzzy, but I think that at Gilgal, he was at Gilgal twice, and one of those times he offered sacrifices himself. I don't know if that was such, you know, well, they did have a high priest. I guess he could have gotten the high priest to do it. But Clark condemns him for that. He not only offered sacrifices which belonged to the priest alone, but in the most positive manner went opposite to the orders of that God whose vicegerent he was. Of his conduct in visiting the women at Endor, I've already given my opinion, and to this I must refer. His desperate circumstances imposed on the weakness of his mind, and he did, in that instance, an act which, in his jurisprudential capacity, he had disapproved by the edict which banished all witches from Israel. Yet in this act, he only wished to avail himself of the counsel and advice of his friend Samuel. I should say his ex-friend Samuel. Taking Saul's state and circumstances together, I believe there is not a coroner's inquest in this nation, that's Britain, that would not have brought in a verdict of derangement, guilty for reasons of insanity. While the pious and the humane would everywhere have consoled themselves with the hope that God had extended mercy to his soul. Well, Adam Clark tries to be nice to Saul, but basically Adam Clark says that Saul was a pathetic wretch of a human being, and that's the opinion I hold too. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished 1 Samuel. I hope you stay tuned for the next audio as we'll start in the first chapter of 2 Samuel. See you then. Hope you enjoyed this audio.